Today is June the 28th, 2017. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show, the original radio program on all things personal computing. I'm Hank Key, and in the studio with me tonight is Joe King, my colleague, and we are heard each Wednesday on the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM, on the Internet at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, and on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York on the radio at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Our website is pcradioshow.org. Our broadcasts are available for downloading from prn.fm, wbai.org, and our website, pcradioshow.org. And whenever WBAI is fundraising, we may be preempted by a replacement program, but we will always be on prn.fm because we will continue to have regular program schedule each week.
Well, Hank, upcoming, instead of a regular program on July 12th, we're scheduling a special broadcast of the convergence of technology with health issues. It's going to be headed up by Dr. Alfred Poor and his associate, Dan Rosenblum. And it's interesting because on that very date, 60 years ago, 1957, the Surgeon General of the United States, Leroy Birney, using his technology, using his science, came up with the fact that we all accept today, but then was radical, cigarettes kill. I wish he had told me that about 5 years before when I started smoking, but...
Now, Joe, 60 years ago, you were a young man. Would you have listened to him?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Absolutely not. Well, Hank, you know, every Wednesday night when we do our show, we have a closing segment. About half the show is unfeatured. There is Alfred Poor on health matters, and there's
Marty Winston.
Marty Winston, who's done the smart home features for us. Well, we're adding to that this week. David Perry is going to begin a series in which each week he's going to address a security issue in greater depth. That's going to be malware. That's going to be viruses. That's going to be all sorts of things of great interest to you, including something that Hank is going to talk about a little tonight, VPNs.
Yeah, well, I hope we can get to that. But, you know, the main news right now is really a piece of malware that is started in Europe, in Ukraine, and is spreading very rapidly. And I understand it hit the shores of the United States, and it's called Petya, P-E-T-Y-A. I don't know if it's called Petya or Petya, but I'm going to call it Petya. And we're going to talk about what it is and what you can do about it. What is Petya, Joe?
Petya is a surprise because after last May when...
This past couple months, not you mean this recent May?
This recent May, yeah. A thing hit the world, which everybody was calling a variation of WannaCry. And WannaCry spread a piece of software which was called ransomware across the world. And it was very simple. You either paid them the money they asked, or you never got your computer unencrypted, which is how they started it. Well, now Petya discovered that most people didn't pay any attention to WannaCry. They didn't patch their software the way they should. They didn't pay attention to what they were downloading the way they should. As a matter of fact, they were just carrying on as usual before WannaCry came along. And guess what Petya is? It's yet another ransomware.
It's a copycat.
It's a copycat, but it's even more vicious because one of the very first places that was hit fully was a hospital, which now had to tell all of their attendants and assistants and nurses to go manually check the radiation for their cancer patient, manually check the amount of drugs that were going in for their chemotherapy. I mean, Hank, I don't know what the penalty for running a ransomware thing like this is, but I think it should be a capital crime.
Well, you know, one of the things about this one, Petya, is that when WannaCry came out, a lot of people looked at it and they say, hey, there are vulnerabilities in WannaCry itself. And they identify what the poor coding was, and they talk about how do you go about fixing it. guess what? With Petya, they fixed it. And in other words, it's really a stronger version of WannaCry with all the vulnerability taken out. And I mean, it's sort of like we're almost like asking for it. By the way, here's how you should fix it before you do it again.
Exactly. But there's somebody, something, some organization that we should really thank for this type of ransomware, because without the assistance and the connivance and the let's face it, the NSA and the CIA are supposed to be protecting us.
They collected all the different tools. And even they added to the collection or library of tools as their own tools, and they got hacked into. They got hacked, let's face it. They put it online of all things. Okay,
when you have a cracker's toolkit like this, which not only is it effective, but they've used the government facilities to find holes in Microsoft and other operating systems. And they've used their facilities, which are paid for by you and me, to create a really good hacker's kit, and then they put it online for a hacker to get?
Well, it's like what they threw down the gauntlet and say, we're good. Let's see if you can find out what we have. I mean, that's what it comes out to.
Who was it? Gary Hart was running for president.
Oh, yeah.
and he was...
Let's say he had a sexual escapade.
Regardless of his sexual escapade, he did not like the way the
press,
the major media, the national media, were covering him. So he threw out a challenge and he said, if you think I'm doing wrong, why don't you just follow me 24 hours a day?
And they did it.
So they followed him for 24 hours a day and then published the women he was involved with. It was a very dirty thing, but... Hey, he asked for it. I mean, he literally asked for it.
Well, let's talk about Petya, okay? In other words, we're telling the listening audience that this is a serious piece of malware. What can they do about it, all right? Well, before you get to it, let's how you can prevent it from happening to you. There are three things that you should observe. Let's talk about the first one, all right? Most people, when they install the operating system, they are in administrative mode. Get yourself out of administrative mode and create a user ID without administrative mode, which allows you to update, modify the operating system, and that's what you want to do.
Well,
now,
wait, stop. What operating system?
Windows.
So this is mainly aimed at Windows.
Correct. Windows, and it's all versions of Windows.
And it doesn't matter whether I'm running Windows 7, 8, 10, I'm vulnerable.
You're right. You're vulnerable. Now, I was talking to you, Joe, about... create a new user ID and use a new one. You say, yeah, but I got all this stuff on this current ID. What can I do? Well, first of all, with Windows, you must have an ID in administrative mode, with that capability. What you can do is if that's the only ID you have, you create another administrative ID. So you could call it XYZ, ABC, whatever you want to call it. Give that the administrative mode. Then reboot the system into using that ID and make the current one you're using non-administrative. And then you don't have to change anything.
Without going into step-by-step explanation, Hank, which I know would take a little time, basically, how do they do that? Do they go to device
user profile.
Manager? Or they
no, user profile.
In the control panel.
Correct. All right. Now, if you do that, then... Now, what I thought you were going to ask me is, well, now, there are certain restrictions. In administrative mode, it's really main... excuse me. It's mostly used for installing programs, making modifications, and being able to get at registries and so on. For normal processing, you don't need to do that. Now, I have found that there is an exception to it that can affect some application programs in terms of running, not installing. Installing, I could see, all right? But I find that with portable apps, you know what I mean by portable apps, okay? You got to run that in administrative mode. So you have to, look at it again and weigh the choices you have.
Folks, for those of you who don't run portable apps, they're a form of program that you can run without actually installing it on your computer.
Correct.
You copy it to the computer, but you don't install it.
Right. And there's a lot of good programs that can run in portable apps. And the advantage of a portable app is you can move it from machine to machine, whereas if you have to install it like onto a Windows operating system, and very often people would say, I want to move my Microsoft Office from machine A to B. I lost the distribution disk. What do I do? Can I just copy it from A to B? The answer is no. You have to reinstall it again. But there are people that have made modifications to existing applications to be portable, but then you could just move it easily, but you need administrative mode to run it.
Incidentally, Hank, I use portable apps all the time, but for a different reason. On one of those little thumb drives or USB drives or whatever you want to call it, I have a nice 32-gigabyte one. It cost very little money. And I moved on to it. All the programs I like to work with on a daily basis in the portable app version. And I can now go to my wife's machine or to Hank's machine or to a machine in the library and plug that in. I'm not installing anything. I'm not fouling up their hard drive, and I can do my day's work.
Well, and then there are certain portable apps where you need it. For instance, the one that I run is called InfoWin, which allows me to get information on more than just Windows, but the whole system itself. Like, I want to know, is the system heating up? It tells me the temperature it's running at. Because we're in the summer months now, and some of us, we run it in a non-air-conditioned room, and you make sure that you don't overheat the system. So things that go outside and looks at the hardware, you need administrative control. So you got to be careful of that.
I'll tell you, Hank, a funny thing happened to me the other day. I was sitting in the library using my tablet, not their computer, and my cell phone, it was in my left-hand pocket, and I felt my left-hand pocket getting very hot. Finally, it got to the point where it was burning my leg. I forgot my cell phone was there. I reached into my pocket, burned my fingers, pulled out the cell phone, checked, and it was 124 degrees.
Well, most people don't realize that a CPU, I know more about Intel than AMD, the Intel CPU, before it cuts off, in other words, when it reaches a certain temperature, it can say, it's getting hot, I'm going to cut off. You know what that temperature is? 174 degrees Fahrenheit.
That's very hot. You can get a blister at that.
Yeah, you can. Now, the other thing you can do to protect yourself when Petya coming in is disable the ability to automatically do reboots. In other words, each time you have to, you have the option to say each time the system reboots, it has to be done manually. It cannot be done automatically under program control. Because the way Petya works is that it can sneak in through phishing, through faking you out and thinking you have a UPS or a FedEx message, and it really wasn't. You don't have a package coming in, but you got fooled. And look, people get fooled, and some of the stuff looks very real, especially when you're expecting a package, okay, you can go into the operating system and say that on a reboot, it's got to be done manually. It cannot be done automatically. So now, that's the second thing that you have to be careful of.
Where would you do that, Hank?
Well, you have to go to the control panel and go through the various functions.
Now, the other thing you can do, Hank said sometimes you'll be told you're getting a package and this is the receipt or this is the bill. I got one the other day that was very, very logical because I had just finished doing a great deal of business with Amazon, and this was about my recent Amazon order. Do something that I do as a matter of course. The language varies depending on what email program you're using. But at some point, the email program will allow you to look at who the email is from. Instead of just saying Amazon, it'll give you the full address. And you'll find that the address is, well, it sounds like it's Amazon. The address on this particular one was amazondeliveries.x.com.
Or it could be service.amazonrsvp, something like that.
They make up something. But as long as you know that it's not just the company, don't open it.
Now, there's a third thing that you can do to make sure that your properly protected against Petya, and that is make sure you have a that you always have an up-to-date copy of your backup. In other words, you could say, I back up, but do you have an up-to-date copy? Because if you do it once a week and you have things that are critical that's constantly changing every day, then you should be backing up every day. Now,
Hank has told me this. We've known each other for 30, 40 years. He's told me this virtually
every day. How many times I got to tell you, you don't back up at all?
Well, back when I was running my company in a different mode than it is now, I did have to back up, and Hank recommended in those days that I use jumbo tapes and this program and that. And he helped me, actually came into the office and helped me set up what he considered an approved backup method and retention method. Retention was just as important. And, of course, one day my system crashed. I called Hank and I said, my system crashed. And he said, no problem. Go to these tapes and those tapes and just load them. So I did. And guess what? They wouldn't load.
Because you backed it up without verification. You got to make sure your backup has verification. And the other thing, by the way, and along with the backup, as an added measure, is that if you back it up to an external device or to the cloud or some of these paid services, make sure that it's readily available. In other words, they could say, yeah, we got your backup. Wait 24 hours. We'll get it to you. If that's okay with you, that's fine. But if you need it immediately, make sure it's readily available and there's no ifs, ands, or buts about it.
It was either the last week or the week before last. There was a foul-up on much of the network that Amazon uses, a great deal of it. And if your backup was in the cloud up in Amazon on that very day that they were down, you're in trouble. You're out of business that day. Mm. My policy is always have two backups. One of them is on-site, and one of them can either be in your home, in the cloud, wherever you want it. But one of them has to be separate from the other.
Well, you know, when you say separate, being in the same location is not necessarily the optimum, because if you have a fire, it doesn't matter what room it's in.
No, that's why I said one can be at home, one can be in the cloud, but one has to be at your office and one has to be someplace else.
Mm-hmm. By the way, in this past week, the big news, a really big news, I'll tell you how big it is, $2.7 billion.
Oh, I thought you were going to say yen.
No, $2.7 billion or... when I originally read it, I said, gee, I think the New York Times got it wrong. They said $2.4 billion. What happened was it's $2.4 euro, and they left off the word euro, but it's $2.7 billion. And this is the European Union fine against Google. That's a huge amount of money, a lot of money, $2.7 billion. And what they're saying is that they're running a business that is sort of like they're the big elephant in there that is inhibiting other people. And because of the way they do searches, now, we've been trying to verify how true this is, and we come up with different results. We really don't don't see it the way they see it. I mean the European Union.
No, Hank, you're looking at that wrong. The way Google operates in each country or each region of the world can be different. The way they're working the Google product here in New York can be different from the way they're working it in Yokohama or Berlin or any place else. So I can't say the fact that I can't replicate what the EU is complaining about. But basically what the EU is complaining about, and Google is saying that's nonsense, is they said that if you should put in a price search, and if you phrased it in a general way that you're asking Google to do, let's say, find you the best price on a given item, they're saying that the very first hit that comes back will be a Google-owned product, a Google-owned cost comparison product. Now, the question is, well, what's the difference? The EU is saying, well, Google is selling advertising on their cost comparison product, and they're getting more hits, therefore they're getting more dollars, and therefore it's unfair competition for the smaller European companies that might also be running a price comparison product.
Well, you know, this coincidentally, with this fine, came about the same time that Google made an announcement about discontinuing a practice that they were doing, and I wasn't even aware of it, is that they anything that goes through their browser, which is Chrome, or you go through their search engine, anything goes through it, they look at every word.
No. That is wrong. That's okay. Absolutely wrong. They don't look at anything, but they have an algorithm that compares and searches for certain words.
Okay, you called. They look.
I call looking something a human being does with two eyes or one eye.
Well, let me put it this way: if you do a search on certain words, to me, you have to search the whole text to find those words. Okay, I mean it's.
Well, that's going through the whole text. There's
and,
no question.
And what it is that they build up a profile, and that's why sometimes when you do a search on a given product or a given piece of news, and all of a sudden you get a pop-up ad. And
well, not even with Google, I find, and we tested it a few minutes ago. I did a search, best price for Honda Civic.
Mm-hmm.
And I hit the button, and within a matter of milliseconds, up popped an ad for a Camaro, for a Camry, for a Chevrolet, for a Ford.
But not a Civic.
I had to go down two full pages before I found the first item on Honda, and even then it wasn't a Civic.
Well, no. I want to get back to that news item about Google. They're saying that they will cease doing that, okay? However, they didn't say that they will forever cease it, right?
No, they said they will cease doing it, but we know that
it's a suspension more than anything else.
We know that they now have a algorithm that lets them search email and find out in the email whether there's any keywords that advertising would pull down. And they said they're no longer going to do that. Well, that's fine.
No. The announcement is they didn't say no longer do it. They say we will not do it. But that doesn't mean they no longer
but
will.
But they still know. They're not going to erase their memory. They know how to do it, Hank.
Well, let me ask you this, okay? What makes you think that their competitors will not do it? Or they say, well, gee, that's because they stopped doesn't mean that we're going to stop because they already have an advantage over us.
Well, that's one thing. I'm looking at it differently. I'm saying there's two guys sitting in Yahoo right now saying, gee, that's a good idea. How can we search through Hank's mail?
You know, originally you said to me they only have one competitor, and I said, no, there's a lot of search engines out there. And, for instance, Microsoft with the Bing and MSN, right? You got Yahoo and...
Wait a minute, Hank. Microsoft doesn't have to do this with Bing because they already do it with Outlook.
Yes, okay, you're right. But it's really a shame that... they even do it, and unfortunately, we've been conditioned to accept it as that's part of doing business.
Well, back in the day, Hank and I used to say, that's because you're looking for a free product. Now, if you're willing to pay for the product, that won't happen. But it's changed. Now, nobody's paying for that type of a product.
But you know that Google also made another announcement, and that they will no longer in a search go through private medical records. I said, wait a minute. You mean they were going through private medical records on searches?
And
I was shocked by that.
I said to Hank, the reason that they stopped doing that is because they're breaking a federal law, HIPAA, the health information something or other law. You cannot just look at somebody's medical record. You have to have permission to do it.
Well, what if they were to scan through it and do it as collective data as opposed to specific data?
My guess is, and it's just a guess, that you could get away with it, but I don't know. I'm not a lawyer.
In other words, they want to find out in a certain demographic area how many people are smokers, how many people are interested in certain products. But they're not identifying a specific individual.
Do you know the term data mining, Hank?
Yes, I know that.
Do you know what big data means, Hank?
Yes, I know what that is. Have I done it? Yes. Hey, I want to go through one more thing, and I want to talk about a first look. It's something that I've been looking at, And if you find that all this search business is bugging the hell out of you because you're losing your privacy, or you say,
Wait a minute. You don't have any privacy.
I was just going to say, you say, wait a minute, I have no privacy. Well, if you're sending out email, okay, and you want some privacy, there's a piece of email that is a service that you could use, and I've tried it. It's called Proton Mail, ProtonMail, and it was developed as open source email program. It was written by MIT and CERN. Now, I know what MIT stands for, which is Massachusetts Institute of Technology, but what's CERN?
Well, I can't give you the exact words, but it's the European Center for Nuclear Studies.
Something like that, okay? But so it's because one of the problems that I find is that you try to use a program that is, by the way, it's a free program because it's open source. When you try to use a program, what happens is that anything that's free or free storage, no matter who the company is, it may go away. But this is MIT, this is CERN, so at least...
No. It has nothing to do with MIT or CERN anymore.
No more?
No. The people who wrote it were from MIT and from CERN.
Oh, it's from, okay. Well, let me put it this way. I've tried it, and I could tell you that it looks like Gmail. It runs more sluggish than Gmail, but that's because they're doing encryption on the data, and they are blocking the IP address.
What they're doing is they've taken PGP, which is pretty good privacy. Mm-hmm. Was that Phil Zimmerman who wrote
that? Yeah, it was.
And they're encrypting it at the point of creation of your email. They do not have themselves the public key the private key to unencrypt it.
Yeah, only you have. If you lose it, you lost it.
And then it sends out to the other end. What I'm not clear on is for that to work, does both parties have to have Proton?
Yes.
So therefore, the unencryption is done by PGP in Proton.
Correct.
At the other end.
Yeah. Now, by the way, we were talking about Opera VPN, and you made a statement to me, and I said, you're wrong. And you said, no, I'm wrong. It turns out you're half right, and I'm half right, okay?
There you go.
Because what happened, you said that you installed Opera with the VPN function, and you turn it on, and you could be using Chrome, and it seems to be working with it. And I said, no, it only works with Opera. What it is that when you turn the VPN on in Opera, they block the IP address, and they leave it blocked, okay, so that when another program needs it, it happens to them. Because one of the things I said to you that I don't like about Opera with VPN is it times out on too many URLs that I use.
Well, that means that it slows down your system so much that before the connection is made, you're timed out. But, Hank, you can go to the Play Store and download Opera's VPN without downloading Opera.
Okay. Well, we're going to get to our second half of the show. I want to tell you that with Alfred Poy, he's going to talk about the use of virtual reality technology with dentistry. He's going to cover the what I didn't realize is called smart pill with prescription medication and bionic implants in hearing technology. And David Perry will do a macro view of security before he gets down to the itty-bitty of it. And Marty Winston is going to talk about Energy Star power supply. So let's get to it right away.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearable technology from Health Tech Insider. Nobody loves the dentist. Well, maybe some people do, but for many people, sitting in a dentist chair can be a bit of a traumatic and even painful experience. And dentists are always looking for ways to make the experience more pleasurable. A recent study has looked into the use of virtual reality, VR, to see if that has ways that it can help dental patients, especially with their perception of pain during dental procedures. And what they did was they ran a couple different studies. First, they ran an experiment using what's called the cold presser test. People put their hands in ice-cold water and report how much pain they feel. So they divided the subjects into two groups, and one group watched virtual reality scenes using goggles, and the other ones didn't. And it turned out that those who were experiencing being someplace else through the virtual reality, they reported having lower pain sensation than the people who didn't have it. They then did another study of patients during actual dental procedures. Again, they discovered that the patients who used virtual reality experienced less pain than those who didn't have it. In fact, they also discovered a couple other things. One, they gave some subjects a view of a coastal beach experience and gave others an urban cityscape kind of experience. And they discovered that those who had the coastal experience felt less pain than the ones looking at the cityscapes. And furthermore, if the patient was given the ability to control their movement throughout the virtual reality environment, that control also helped reduce the pain even further. Virtual reality could give us the ability to be someplace else when we're going through something uncomfortable, like some dental procedures, and could well help us take a mini vacation and go someplace beautiful while that's going on. And apparently, according to these studies, can help reduce the pain that we might experience in that process. Prescription medications are probably one of the biggest miracles of modern medicine. It's amazing the number of life-threatening, life-ending diseases and conditions that can be stalled or corrected or completely conquered using various medications that we have at our disposal. It's really quite wonderful what medication is able to do for patients. One of the big problems, though, is that people don't always take their pills when they're supposed to. And it's a huge problem. According to one study, the lack of adherence to medical instructions, just for patients with chronic diseases, results in almost 10% of all hospitalizations in the U.S. It also results in about 125,000 deaths. And the total costs are up to $290 billion, billion with a big B, $290 billion in increased healthcare costs every year just because people don't take their medication when they're supposed to. So it's a huge, huge problem. Another data point, almost half of the medications for chronic diseases aren't taken as prescribed. So what can we do about this? Well, it's really in the interest of healthcare systems to make sure that patients take their medications as prescribed so that they get the proper treatment. Because if they don't, it's going to result in those increased costs, which are avoidable. One healthcare system out in Chicago, Illinois, the Rush University Medical Center, has started using a smart pill system. What this does is it relies on a tiny microchip, smaller than a grain of sand, which is attached to each individual pill that the patient is prescribed. Each of these pills is unique and can identify each specific pill. The way it works is the patient wears a sensor that sticks to their abdomen, to their stomach, really like a big Band-Aid. What happens is when the patient takes the pill, as it passes through the digestive system, when that chip passes by that sensor attached to the outside of their body, the sensor registers the chip as it goes by and then wirelessly sends that information to an app on a smartphone or some other device. And this records the fact that the patient took the pill and records the time and the date. And so it verifies that the pill has been taken. The Rush University Medical Center has been using this system with patients who are hypertensive, patients with high blood pressure. And they're using this so that they can monitor their adherence to the prescription medicines. This is a system made by a company called Proteus. It's called their Discover system. It's already being used in 8 health systems around the country. If it turns out that monitoring a patient's adherence to the prescription instructions pays off, we can expect to see smart pills being used more and more by healthcare systems. In the past, I've talked about a number of different kinds of bionic implants that can be used to help replace vision and other kinds of senses. But there's one area that hasn't been addressed to the same degree, and that's hearing. If you think about it, microphones, such as the one I'm using right now, are fairly common and well understood. They're able to take the varying sound waves, the different pressures of the sound waves, as they hit a diaphragm and convert those vibrations into electrical currents that can then be recorded and played back, and so you can hear my voice. The eardrum performs a very similar function. It vibrates with the sound waves. It then transmits those vibrations through the inner ear to nerve cells that can receive those vibrations and translate them into nerve impulses. The problem is if you don't have that functioning inner ear, what you would need is a replacement for the eardrum that could, instead of passing along the vibrations, could actually convert those vibrations into electrical signals that could then be sent directly to the brain to stimulate the brain to create the sensation of sound. The problem is most microphones use a rigid material for the diaphragm, the part that vibrates with the airwaves. Researchers in China have approached this problem and have come up with a very thin, flexible material that is thinner than the thickness of a typical human hair, but has the sensors built into it, and they can convert those vibrations into electrical currents that could then stimulate the brain. The interesting thing about this is that the system has the frequency response that should provide adequate accuracy to replace human hearing. It has a response of about 20 hertz. A hertz is a vibration per second, so that's a very low frequency, all the way up to 13 kilohertz, 13,000 vibrations per second. And that compares very favorably with the typical human range of hearing, which is from 20 hertz to 20 kilohertz. So you lose a little on the high end. However, I can tell you that I know my hearing doesn't go up to 20 kilohertz anymore. Something that was 20 to 13 kilohertz would be a perfectly adequate solution for most people. This research could lead to an implant that could replace the eardrum and create a signal that could then stimulate the brain directly. It could be a whole new avenue for restoring the hearing for people who have lost it. For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred.
Hi, this is David Perry for the Personal Computer Show, and I've got some things to talk to you about. First, hello. I haven't been here in a long time, and I'm very happy to be back here on the air with Hank and Joe. And second, I want to talk to you about computer security. Now, I have spent almost all of my adult life selling computer security products for one company or another. And although all those products are good products, and they've done wonderful things, the antivirus, the VPN, the firewalls, all the things, you know, the various things that I've done, those products are all good products. I use them myself. But that's not enough. In order to protect yourself on the internet, and in order to even have a chance to protect yourself in the future, you are going to have to know some things about what you're protecting it from, and why you're protecting it. What are the possible outcomes? Now, I'm going to touch on this today, but we can't cover those topics today. They're just too long. So this is just kind of an introduction. So let's start at the beginning. What are you protecting? Primarily in the world, you are protecting data, access, your reputation, money, property, and privacy. And privacy is a tricky thing because I know people who say, I have nothing to hide. I'm not a criminal. I don't care who sees my privacy. But ladies and gentlemen, when you lose your privacy, it is awfully hard to secure your civil rights. Now, I've been teaching people about this for a long time. I've been asked to put this in order for a speech I'm giving in Vienna, Austria in the end of summer. So I'm working on it. And as I'm working on it, you're going to get the benefit of that. No matter where you get this information, you're going to be getting it from me, whether you're at PRN or the podcast, or if you follow me at davidperryvirus.com, that blog is going to spring back to life with this information. So let's talk about protecting your data. What do we mean when we say protecting your data? Now, what is your data? Your data is the documents, the photographs, the music, all of the things that you've got on your computer, on your computer system. Now, the most obvious way you're protecting your data is against ransomware. Ransomware busts onto your system and encrypts all of that data so that you can't see your photographs or copy them onto another drive. You can't listen to your music. You can't read your documents, that novel you've been writing, your college transcripts or your paper that you're working on. You can't get to them because they're encrypted. And they're encrypted by criminals. And they're encrypted by criminals who are not inside the United States. And what they want you to do is to ransom your data, to give them money in Bitcoin, the international cryptocurrency, so that it can be bought back from them. And to tell you the truth, if you pay them, there's a chance that they will give you back your data. There's also a chance that they will not give you back your data. They're criminals. They don't have to do anything. This is not a business. So you're going to want to protect your data from that, okay? You're also going to want to protect your data for privacy's sake. You don't want somebody nosing around inside your computer reading the data that's on your system. You also don't want somebody coming in and erasing all the data. This used to happen with the prankster viruses of old, where even something like Michelangelo that would come in and erase all of your data. So don't be afraid for the physical hardware of your computer. I say that because I know somebody out there who's listening is thinking that what they're protecting is their hardware. You're not protecting your hardware. You're not protecting your operating system. You're not protecting your applications. You are protecting your data. And that you're protecting it against a number of things. And the very first thing, as Hank will always tell you, to protect your data is to back it up. So if you haven't backed up your data, I urge you, put your playback on pause and go back up your data right freaking now. Back up your data, back up your data, back up your data. That's the first and most necessary thing to protect your data. The second thing you might think about doing is encrypting your data. And we're going to talk about that way down the line because we're still in the outline section of this lesson. So I'm going to go just a little longer and say it's been wonderful being associated through the years with the Personal Computer Show. I'm very happy to have always been a part of this show. And I would like to say from the dulcet shores of Huntington Beach, California, cowabunga dudes, surf's up. This is David Perry.
Thank you, Dave. And now a presentation by Marty Winston on Star Energy on internal power supplies.
When I talk about our 40-year house project, 40yearhouse.com, Hank's backup, backup, backup advice mantra is almost always there. And I seem to deal with backing up electrical power to the intelligent systems almost more than anything else. And, you know, that's okay, because in the process of finding out more about that, I'm learning some scary things. Well, they shouldn't be scary, but they are, about what we all have to deal with on the backup front that most of us don't expect. And some of it goes back to the Department of Energy, not so very many years ago. This has to do very specifically with internal power supplies in computers and things that, well, you know, are like computers or are built based on computers, and that might be industrial control systems. It might be workstations, might be gaming consoles. If it's got if it's something with an internal power supply and not just a brick feeding a battery, an internal power supply, regulations took effect under Energy Star not so very long ago that made for a new era and some new confusion. Hang in there. I'm going to get to specifics, but you need to understand a little bit of the why so the wherefore starts making sense. In the good old days, maybe 10 years ago, right? 15, you know, you want to stretch it. In the good old days, the power supply in what we used to call a PC system unit was this little rectangular solid box that would take AC power on one end and have a whole bunch of wires or sockets for delivering DC on the other end. And it, you know, it's what power supplies have always been. Take AC in, pump DC out. Sometimes you pump in different levels of AC. In case of computers, it's almost always DC. Okay, not bad, except that while they were kind of okay, their efficiency tended to be, maybe 65 to 80%, top and maybe be 85%. And when you multiply that by the heck of a heck of a heck of a heck of a lot of PCs that came to be out there, well, the power utilities started noticing, DOE started noticing, large organizations started noticing, and the inefficiencies started adding up. If you're 80% efficient, you're 20% inefficient. And that 20% of power is what? Anybody? Everybody knows. Wasted power is most likely to turn into heat. And what happens to heat inside things like computers? It calls for a change in the physics of the components. It manifests itself as premature aging of the components. It shows up as early failures. these things get old before their time, no matter what their time is. I'm not sure how to figure that out, but they don't have to age as quickly as they have. The heat inside the case has contributed to that. So, you know, okay, here we are with not ideal power supplies. Well, yada, yada. You're going to do something about it? Energy Star did. They mandated all internal power supplies on computerized gear in order to get Energy Star certification, had to have a much more efficient technology creating power. And there was and is such a technology that deals with power factor correction. It's a weird thing. I'll get into that in a second, but I want to preface it by saying there's only one kind we're going to pay attention to right now of the two kinds that exist. There is a passive PFC, PPFC, that uses, it's called passive because it uses passive components, things like inductors and capacitors. And all that's really doing is smoothing or cleaning up the sine wave a little bit. If you ever take a look at the sine wave that comes in at the wall plug, it's a little bit dirty. It's from reflections. It's from harmonics. It's from RF noise or electromagnetic noise. A lot of things that contribute to that. So if you've got a smoothing component, something like a capacitor or the inductor, it will have some effect. And it does, because of that effect, improve efficiency, but only a little bit. That's passive PFC. Active PFC has its own microcontroller governing what the power supply is doing. Several times, many, many, many times, it's clocking the segment of sine wave that it's on right now. It's measuring that voltage. It knows what to expect at that moment along the waveform and what it has to do to efficiently convert that particular voltage to the DC output the power supply needs to have. So step by step, meticulous, unforgiving. It's assuming total control over the conversion. So, you know, active PFC becomes very, very efficient in the 90s, some of them very close to 100% efficient. Active PFC solves a lot of the waste problem that the industry and DOE and everyone else was looking at. And in so doing, you know, a given size power supply now can handle more power. A smaller power supply can be built to handle the same power. There's less heat, a lot of pluses, all to the good. Okay, do you care? Yeah, you will. Hang in. So, okay, you've got an active PFC power supply that is meticulously riding the line voltage. Most of the UPSs that were out there when that regulation was passed were using a waveform called simulated sine wave. Simulated sine wave isn't a sine wave at all. It isn't smooth like a roller coaster. It isn't smooth like what you've seen on the sci-fi shows. It is stepped. It stepped partway up and then all the way up and then back down to partway up and then down to zero and then partway down, then all the way down, which isn't really all the way, then halfway down and then back to zero. And that keeps repeating. If you look at the corners of those little steps, look at the corners of the rectangles that make up those steps, you'll see they intersect the sine wave several times. It's only intersecting the corners. At those little instants, the voltage value at that step is exactly what the voltage value would be on a sine wave. And for decades, we got away with that. Those simulated sine waves were able to deal with equipment because the equipment was itself a little bit sloppy, a little bit forgiving in how it dealt with that stuff. Forgiving is not in the vocabulary of an active PFC. If an active PFC sees the wrong voltage, well, that's not terrible. It's going to adjust what it's doing in that instant so that the DC that comes out still is what it should be, despite the fact that the AC that's in is a little bit weird. Except when you're at zero, which happens at the beginning, middle, and end of every sine wave or simulated sine wave waveform. If you're at zero for too long, it sees that as a power failure. So if your gear is new, here's the important part. If your gear is new, if it says active PFC or just plain PFC, if it says Energy Star, and you put it into a simulated sine wave UPS, the odds are that sooner or later, the moment that that UPS kicks in will be a moment of or milliseconds before the active PFC power supply reads its presence as an absence of power and unpredictably shuts, well, predictably, if you're paying attention to this, shuts down the gear that you're really trying to protect. True sine wave is the only out. The true sine wave power supplies that are out there today can absolutely work dependably with active PFC power supply. Now, I'm mentioning all of this because of some news from, you know, I know these guys, our friends over at CyberPower, which is my favorite UPS house. There are others. CyberPower just got one of its units, the GX1325U or GU or UG or something, the GX1325 picked up for sale in the store at Best Buy. It is the first and only true sine wave UPS that you can walk into a store, look at, and buy. It's really a cool development. Now, 1325 VA, it comes out to be about 810 watts, I think. It's got automatic voltage regulation, so it's going to adapt to the power line better than normal and won't go to batteries just because you got a slight brownout or slight high on the power line. It's got active PFC, so it's true sine wave. It's going to be a lot better for all of that Energy Star gear. It's even going to be better if you're working with audio or video where clean power makes a difference. But one thing I'm going to tell you, real street pricing on this is under $200. Active PFC in retail, true sine wave in retail, mini tower, under $200. It may not make headlines elsewhere, but it impresses the heck out of me. So don't be afraid. Even if you have Energy Star and active PFC in the internal supplies in your new gear, you can still back up, back up, back up. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Marty. Just to remind everyone, on Wednesday, July 12th, we will have a special broadcast on the convergence of technology with health issues. On that date in 1957, the U.S. Surgeon General Leroy Burney linked smoking with lung cancer. Public service announcements of regional computer club meetings in this area. The Brookdale Computer Users Group will be meeting on Thursday, June the 29th at 6:45 p.m. and the topic of presentation is Tuning Up Your Windows PC, Middletown Library, Large Community Room in Middletown, New Jersey. The Westchester PC Users Group will be having a presentation on Create Stunning Photos Like a Pro, Using Your Mobile Device with Free Apps, Thursday, July 6th at 7 p.m., Keller Williams Realty, 120 Bloomingdale Road, room number 101, White Plains, New York. The Danbury Area Computer Society will have a presentation on using the iPad with a person living with dementia. Tuesday, July 11th, 7:30 p.m. at the Danbury Hospital Auditorium in Danbury, Connecticut. Rockland PC Users Group will be meeting Tuesday, July 11th, 2017 at 7:15 p.m. Rassel Room on the fourth floor of the Palisades Moor in West Nyack. The New York Amateur Computer Club will be meeting on Thursday, July 13th, 7 p.m. at NYU in the Silver Building, room 411, 31 Washington Place in Manhattan, New York. If you have a computer club meeting I might not have mentioned, just send me a notification with date, time, place, and subject if possible to hank@pcradioshow.org. With all of these club meetings, it's open to the public and free of charge, and they hope to be seeing you there. The website for the Personal Computer Show is pcradioshow.org, and we communicate via Twitter at pcradio212. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM, on the Internet at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York, on the radio, or WBAI.org, streaming on the Internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing, and always back up, back up, and back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and stay cool until we meet again. Same time, same station next week.